This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
You can see the confidence build day by day, and there is an electricity to his personality on the field that's really hard to look away from.
Starring Jerry DePoto.
And Jerry DePoto to the plate with a 2-2 pitch to Alex. Swing and a miss. He struck him out on the fastball.
With Aaron Goldsmith.
And now chapter three is, he's a real ball player. He's an impactful player. He can do a ton for your team, and this is a guy that can really help to solidify a big league lineup.
And Gary Hill Jr.
He seems along those lines where he wants to be great and does everything possible to go get it.
It's time for the Wheelhouse. Here's Aaron.
Welcome once again to the Wheelhouse podcast. It is our final Wheelhouse on Root Sports. Remember, you can find the full version of this conversation. Gary, where is that again?
Anywhere you get your podcast.
That's right. There he is. Our great friend, Gary Hill, along for the ride as always, and joined by Jerry DePoto. Jerry, it's been a long time. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. I mean, I'm doing even better now, having seen Gary's face as he illuminated by letting
He loves saying that, don't you, Gary? You want to say it again?
Yeah, it's the best thing I say.
Yeah, we have like a real, like Malone, Stockton to Malone thing going on when I dish it off to Gary to throw it down for the wherever you find your podcast. Is that fair, Gary?
Yeah, I'm Malone.
Yeah, you're Malone. I mean, nice. I'm giving it up. I don't think Malone ever passed to Stockton. I don't think that's how that relationship works.
I would prefer Peyton Kemp, to be honest, if we were going to go.
It's a good point. Fair enough. We'll do this again in 3, 2, 1. All right. In any event, Jerry, it's great to be with you again. Man, a lot has happened on the field, off the field, since our last Wheelhouse. First of all, the big news in town, Jerry, the All-Star Game is coming in 2023. This is thrilling news, and I'm sure as a baseball geek that you are, you must be on top of the moon about this.
I really am. You know, I remember even back in the 70s watching the All-Star Game as a kid growing up, and what it has turned into, or how the game has evolved, or even the week has evolved, has turned into something really special with all of the events around the All-Star Game itself. And I think that's going to expand even further by the time we get to 2023, if for no other reason than we're going to watch the Major League Baseball draft evolve, you know, and that's going to be a little bit more of a fan event than it ever has been before. We saw it this past year in Denver, and we're going to see it start to really, I think, you know, get some legs with live fan engagement, especially in the post-pandemic world. And, you know, I know once we get to the third round of the draft, there's not a lot of names that people have heard of, but that will change, my friend. That will change.
Okay. I mean, the Midsummer Classic is the undisputed king of All-Star games. As you have watched this game your whole life, what is it about the All-Star game that resonates the most with you as just a baseball fan?
You get to see the best players in the world on the field at the same time. And you know, the outcome of the game used to matter to me more as a young fan than it does to me now. Now it's about seeing the skills play and watching what these guys can do when they're not inhibited by trying to do the right thing, get the runner over, do the things that allow for you to win a baseball game. It's just straight backyard baseball, swing hard, throw hard, do fun things. And there is some type of appeal to watching the most skilled up players in baseball do those things on the field every day.
You're a pitcher, but are you into the home run derby?
I am. Yeah. I was as a pitcher as well. If being fair. You know, the home run derby is fun. And having seen a home run derby live, it's amazing how into it you can get when you're cheering and the balls are flying all over the place. And you know, our venue should be so much fun because there are a lot of different targets. It's all about the targets.
That's right.
You know, we've got the cantina, we've got the pen, we've got the windows out on the Hit It Here Cafe. there are a number of different targets that, that we can shoot at, even the upper deck, which is rare air that very few of us can reach. And, you know, that makes the experience so much more enjoyable. And I didn't see the Home Run Derby of 2001 when the game was last here, but it, with so much power in the game today and so many targets to hit in our ballpark, I think that'll be fun too.
Well, Gary, the lefty swing in mm-hmm. our ballpark between the windows and the upper deck in right field. That, I mean, I think Jerry brings up a great point. I had not thought of that. The targets in the ballpark, but the windows and above, that's the holy grail.
Yeah, the windows above. And even, I think, a very underrated home run is when you get it into the Hit It Here Cafe, the open portion of the restaurant, more yeah. towards right center field, which is, you have to destroy a ball to get there. It's a very underrated home run to me.
You know, I think, Jerry, you bring up a great point here. I'm now even more excited than I was for the Derby, and I'm a big Derby guy. I mean, the Derby's
a blast.
It's phenomenal. Yeah.
Somebody will hit the ball out of the ballpark.
Oh, we got a bold prediction a couple of years in advance.
Yeah, don't know who that's going to be, but, you know, the left field, and we've seen people come close. You know, sure. We've seen Nelly come close in batting practice. We have seen guys like, say, Aaron Judge come close in real time.
In real life.
So, you know, I do think that that's something that's going to be a target that somebody will overcome a couple of years down the line. Perhaps Julio Rodriguez.
You won't sleep a wink during the All-Star break between the Mariners hosting the game and the draft. Will there be a body double involved here for some appearances, a gala perhaps? Because I don't know how you're going to survive.
I say me and my 29 brethren in other organizations decided this year that from now on, the month of July is just it's no sleep July for baseball operations employees everywhere. You know, with the draft landing in this space, I do think that moving forward, you know, that the July 2nd international free agents, and I don't know what will happen there around the potential for a worldwide draft, but it's likely to land in that same zone. We are talking about the trade deadline and now the All-Star game all landing in this very small space. And, it's why we do what we do. We love it. And, you know, I'll sleep some other time, I guess.
We should not forget about the Futures game, too, in the mix with all of this, which is phenomenal.
The Futures game, as a baseball person, as a front office member, as a part of the scouting community, is maybe the coolest thing of all of the different, you know, parts of the week that is now the All-Star event. And you know, I think with the type of prospects that we have in our system, it's even more exciting to look forward to that 2023 game, imagining that we will have three players out on the field like we have these last couple of years. I think that's the max. Hopefully we can lobby them into a little bit more. But it's, again, seeing your best young players on the field with the best young players in baseball and that age group is a pretty cool thing.
Other news since we last spoke, you and Scott Servais have your contracts extended. Scott will be back. You will be back. You receive a promotion in the mix. You are no longer just a lowly general manager, Jerry. You're a president of baseball operations, for crying out loud. Congratulations in all seriousness. What does this mean for you going from the GM title to president of baseball ops?
First, thanks. And I don't know is the answer to that question. My job has not
changed. You haven't
figured
it out yet?
at least hasn't changed yet in a meaningful way. Other than, you know, one of the things that has really started to evolve over these 3 years since we started this rebuild process is, you know, I have really come to rely on the people around me in a way that I never would have considered when we started this. Is so many of our young managers and coordinators and directors have grown in ways that I wouldn't have expected so quickly. And as a result, I do a lot less now. So, you know, maybe it, like is the case when you get bigger titles, you just do less.
That feels like a natural progression in a healthy organization. You can tell us, it feels like from the outside that the GM job has grown bigger and bigger and bigger as time has gone on.
I think so. It definitely has. And so much so that across the league, now you see setups like ours, where now you have a president of baseball operations and a more robust front office, oftentimes including a general manager or multiple assistant general managers. And as the heavy lifting increases, and there's a lot of different reasons why the game has become, you know, more of a heavy lifting, you know, type, I guess, endeavor. But as that has occurred, one thing that really becomes more and more prominent is the logic or the old adage that the best thing you can do when you achieve power is just give it away. And then you will find more. And, you know, I think that's happening here. And we're seeing it with people like Justin Hollander and Tim Stanton, Scott Hunter and Frankie Thon and Brendan Damaraki and Andy McKay, and even what I would call, you know, our assistant directors that are really growing quickly, like Emmanuel Cifuentes and Frankie Polari, Andrew Herrera, who are in the space growing at a rate that is shocking. And our front office is just as young as our team and just as young as our coaching staff, and that's a pretty special thing to be around every day.
Two things that makes me think of. One, Gary and I talk often about how we are excited for 10, 15, 20 years into the future to see how many people on this staff, this front office staff in baseball ops, go on to become whatever it might be, right? A general manager with another team or a farm director or fill in the blank, because obviously there's a group of talent in the front office that is very impressive. But also, we've talked about this before, about how the role of a manager has changed and how more collaborative of a position that is. I mean, you think back to like Sparky Anderson, right? I mean, I have a pretty good sense that it was kind of what Sparky was feeling that day is what happened.
Oh, yeah.
Which is no slight to Sparky. That was the era, but it's a different era now. And Scott appears to be such a wonderful collaborator, and the amount of synergy that's involved in the coach's room and with the analysts in the front office. But the same must be true for you in your chair as well.
I think so. You know, and first I'll talk about Scott and his evolution as a manager. Having been a farm director, having worked in a front office scenario before, you know, before he became the manager of the Mariners, he learned a lot about the way you communicate and rely on the people around you, the way oftentimes as a farm director, the what's happening at a satellite affiliate is out of your hand, and you have to trust people and communicate well. And I think Scott has gotten better and better at that with each year that we've been here, especially over the last two. And what happened last year during the COVID stoppage was incredibly valuable to the Mariners. The way we learned to communicate, what we were able to do with virtual meetings, and the detail that we were able to go into on things like advanced scouting and baseball strategy, and how educational that was for a really young staff, and how valuable it was for Scott to get to know what the people were capable of. And, you know, the result in 2021 has been the most seamless communication we've ever had on a staff here. And again, like I talked about with our assistant directors, directors, and leaders in the baseball ops group, how quickly they've grown. The same can be said of our coaches. You know, we've got a young coaching staff who very quickly became what I think is one of the best in the league. And the way Scott brings that together has been notable.
We're going to change the order up just a little bit. Don't worry, Stump JD is not coming till the end still. We don't want to ruin you until the very end of the show, because it would make things foggy the rest of the way. We're going to go straight to our listener question this week, because Ari chimes in, and I thought had a really good kind of broad-based question that was going to hit on a number of things that we wanted to talk to you about. He wants to know your biggest takeaways from this season, whether that be in player development in the minors, player development at the major league level as well. Who has shined, who has exceeded expectations? Kind of a 30,000 foot view as to what has gone on growth for the team this year.
How long is this show? You know, first I'll start with the Major League Club. You know, we set out with the goal to get 1% better every day, and just find a way to continually compound the interest. And I think we've achieved that. We wanted to play meaningful games in September. We've achieved that. We wanted to develop our young players. You know, some have developed at a quicker rate than others, but we've achieved our goal, which is to introduce these young players and get them opportunity. We wanted to lay the foundation for a championship core, and we feel like we're doing that. I won't say that we've done that, but we're doing that. And at the minor league levels, in a season that has been as challenging as any not named 2020 that I can ever remember experiencing, most of what we wanted to achieve, we've achieved, and it's gone really well. You know, we've had a couple of small setbacks, injuries, or, you know, a very rare underperformer. But across the board, from our top prospects to young players that really kind of came out of nowhere, a guy that comes to mind is Cade Marlowe, who, you know, for all intents and purposes, you can't have a better season than he just had at the A levels between Modesto and Everett. I think the only minor league player, at last I looked, with 20-plus homers, 20-plus steals, 100 RBI, and, you know, counting stats, but there were notable counting stats. The way Matt Brash broke out, we've talked about him before. He's been phenomenal. In the more than you could have hoped, our first-round pick this past draft was Harry Ford, who went out and absolutely destroyed the Arizona Summer League. And we would have anticipated him doing well, but not quite what he did, which was didn't strike out much, did walk a lot, and threw up 1,000-plus OPS against players that are largely older than he is and looked every bit as athletic as we thought. Watching so many players in our system flourish in so many positive ways, it's been really a joy watching this season. And I can't remember too many days this year where I haven't had a smile on my face because it's gone really well. And I would love to win the World Series. It's probably not in the cards for us in 2021, but it is more realistic than it's ever been for us moving forward. And that was the goal.
Your pitching core, starting pitching core in the minor leagues, has been able to graduate levels and has, I'm guessing, done what you have wanted and more based on some, not maybe surprise performers, but guys who have maybe cropped up that you weren't necessarily anticipating that type of performance. But when you talk about the starting pitching depth in your prospect system, how has that flourished over the course of the year?
Quite well is the answer. And I did mention Brash. You know, Brandon Williamson, who was the first to make the move from Everett to Arkansas and really came on with a rush, especially over the last month, had a terrific season and did all the things we could have hoped, especially the positive of taking the ball every fifth or sixth day and building an innings foundation that allows him, you know, a better starting point in 22. We watched the same progression for George Kirby. George went from an industry number of something around, you know, 80-ish on the prospect lists to the top 15 on most lists. And that's a huge jump. He did it with flashing three pitches that are dynamic on their best day, a fastball that'll touch up to 102, which is pretty awesome considering he throws it where he wants to. And, you know, he's made a seamless transition to double A. A really nice breakout season for Levi Stout, who we saw in the fall last year and had an advanced start on what we thought he was going to be capable of. But he's been terrific. A little bit of a setback in terms of not being able to build the innings we were hoping to with Emerson Hancock. But we saw the physical stuff and, you know, fingers crossed, we've been able to get through it without any substantial injury, more trying to figure out how to build on what has been a fatiguing transition for him from college and a missed season into pro ball. But across the board, what we're doing with our starting pitching, including a young staff in Seattle, has been really all systems go. You can't really ask for any more than we've achieved with this group in this season.
Along those lines, Logan Gilbert finishing strong here in September. Still has a couple starts to go, but how would you characterize Logan's season?
You know, the first thing comes to mind, and this isn't normally something that I'm thinking about, you know, every day, but I was just digging in on it the other day. I think Logan is now the first Mariners rookie to achieve a two-win season F4 since Felix, which is, you know, it's been a while. And for Logan to do what he's done, strike out north of 10 per nine, he has been incredibly stingy with the walks for any pitcher, much less a 24-year-old making his major league debut. And I think just the third Mariners rookie in this century to register a two-win season, the other being Joel Pinheiro, and I believe in 2000. So it's a pretty remarkable run for Logan. He's done it while he reshaped his slider at the major leagues, which is rough to do. We saw a huge step forward for him in both the usage and quality of his changeup. And roughly sitting in the mid to upper 90s in every outing we've seen. And to do that after missing an entire season of innings in 2020 is, again, I pinch myself. He has been terrific, and every bit of what we thought he could do, he's done.
Does the velocity surprise you that it's continued to maintain at the level it has? We saw him 95 to probably 97 in his debut, and we see a lot of guys jacked in their debut for all the obvious reasons, but he touched 98 in his last start. He's been sitting, it feels like, 95 all year long. Is that what you expected, or is that a surprise that the velo has been as high as it has been?
It has to be a surprise to hold the velocity at that level. You know, if you're holding 91, it's a slightly different story than if you're holding 95 and touching 98. And, you know, it's funny. Tammy, my wife, asked me when he was throwing his last outing against the Royals, and he threw a 98-mile-an-hour fastball, I believe, to Sal Perez in the first inning. And she said, is that the hardest Logan throws? I said, currently. And that's the answer to the question. Is it's only a surprise because of the height of the velocity. It's not a surprise if you get to see what Logan does 12 months a year to put himself in position to do what he does. His velocity has increased every year that we've had him, from the time he was drafted to where he is today. It's increased from the start of this season to where he is right now. And the work that he does in his offseason is really, no one puts in more thought to how to prepare to sustain at any level than Logan does. And it gives me great hope that he's going to be able to sustain it for longer, although that velocity level is incredibly difficult to maintain. But who knows? He keeps getting better.
Greatest catch you've ever seen a pitcher make in your entire life?
Wow. Yes.
I'm not sure what the DePoto highlight reel looks like, but that was...
It doesn't look like that. Yeah, it doesn't look like that. Now, the roly-poly?
Yes.
I have that in my game.
Oh, do you?
But catching the ball and then doing that, maybe not. Logan was quick in spring training when Pete Woodworth in 2020 introduced, you know, the AFP program, which is athletic fielding practice. For years and years, the pitchers, we called the defensive work PFP, you know, pitchers fielding practice, which was decidedly unexciting. And and it was a bunch of little tappers, a comebacker, maybe you throw one down the line, then you hit the first baseman in the chest, and we call it a day, we go have a sandwich. And, you know, Woody turned it into something much more enjoyable, AFP. He and Max Wiener, dating back to our minor league development days with this coaching group, you know, wanted to rebrand it. These are athletes. They're going out there and they're working on athletic things. And if you've not seen our morning AFP, our pitchers play positions. You know, we have footage of Logan Gilbert playing shortstop, and, you know, and taking great pride in what they do and practicing. And you've never seen a group enjoy practicing more than this group does. And as a result, I would not have bet back in 2019, you know, or 18 that Logan was going to make play like that. But that's what he's done, you know. And I'd say between he and Chris Flexen, Marco Gonzalez, you know, it really jumps out what our guys are doing defensively, because that's not the way we looked in 2016 and 17. I can tell you that.
Well, the JT Chagua catch, Gary, you want to back me up on this? Is that it might not be the most challenging, but he owned it more than any other pitcher this year. Yeah. And Joe Smith had a great one too.
There's the Joe Smith, when you're covering that type of ground, and that
as
one
a senior
to me,
statesman,
it's a senior or not. And Joe's a tremendous athlete. Unless you've spent time around Joe, you probably don't appreciate just how athletic he is. But to cover that kind of ground and make that play, that's the one you'll remember 20 years from now. And when all of the 900 some odd games that you've pitched in the big leagues are yesterday's news, and you're sitting there with your grandchildren and you're telling them about the time you traversed the, you know, by then it'll be 150 feet to catch the pop up. It's a big thing.
I'll tell you, not to go down too deep of a rabbit hole here, but
we're there, man.
I know. That's what I'm saying. That's why I'm going all in. Tell me I'm wrong on this. Yusei Kikuchi is an incredible fielding pitcher. Like, he doesn't get many chances. Like, there aren't many times where balls get hit in his vicinity. But there's nobody who attacks. I can't believe I'm saying that. There's no pitcher that attacks a ground ball with more conviction than you say.
There's an aggression. You know, it is. It's just yeah. He's aggressive in his style.
I mean, he's really good.
That former Mariner that I had a chance to play with for a period. Former bullpen coach here, Mike Hampton, was like that. Yeah, I mean, Hampton, it was like a puma on the mound, ready to pounce. And Yusei's got some of that in him. It's when Yusei catches the ball, even afterward, you know, when it's time to throw the ball to first base, he looks very lively. You know, most guys, in today's game, most guys will start running toward first base so they can flip it underhand and avoid the, you know, the embarrassment of a bad throw. Yusei, he picks up the ball and it's on. And our group thinks they can make any play. And I think it's because of the AFP practice.
Now, see, I, as co-host of this program, we have the president of baseball operations for like 45 minutes every couple of weeks. I'm a little embarrassed that we just spent 10 minutes talking about pitchers fielding ground balls. But this must be the best 10 minutes of wheelhouse history for you.
I'm beaming. Yeah.
All right.
It's magic.
Fair enough. Well, you know, it's teamwork, right? You know, I'm just trying to make you feel better before Stump JD. All right. So we've touched on Logan, who has been everything essentially that we all thought he would be this year. We know the turbulence that has been in Kelnick's game at times this season, but he has put in together the best month of his young major league career. The surface level numbers are great. The underlying numbers are even better. What have you made of September for Kelnick?
He's been phenomenal. And to this point, you know, when we're recording it, is roughly 1,000 OPS for the month, which is decidedly different than what we'd seen, you know, up to this point. And I don't know why this is, but, you know, in 2020, 2021, transitioning rookies from AAA to the big leagues, or even in some cases from AA to the big leagues, has been incredibly difficult. You know, the gap has never been wider, and I don't know why that is. I don't think it's a matter of the talent being so much greater at the big league level than at AAA. It's the same as it's always been. There might even be more good young AAA players than in most times. But it's been hard, and it hasn't just been hard for Jared or the Mariners. It's been hard in baseball in total, in the non-Wander Franco category.
So there's always an outlier.
Yeah, but you know, to see him start to get his traction, and if you go back and look, and you know, it very slowly in the month of August, you know, we've seen now if you date back to August, and it's going to be somewhat, you know, driven by how good September's been for him. But since the 1st of August, Jared's been our second best hitter. I think he's got a 116 weighted runs created plus since the 1st of August, which only Ty France has bested. And, you know, he's very slowly started to show you the confidence and the execution that we really believed was inevitable for him. And here over these last 3 weeks, it's been getting decidedly louder. And that is what we expected, you know, but it took a little bit longer, and that's what baseball does sometimes. It's just not a linear development, and his got a little bit wobbly, and you know, it tested his, I guess, resolve at times, and never tested our belief. We always believed that we were going to get to this version of Jared Kelnick, and I hope it's here to stay, because these are the things he does. He's got an excellent swing. He's got a great focus. When he's swinging at strikes, you see it happen the way it's happening right now, and he can drive an offense when he's going good, as we've just seen.
It's really interesting when you look at Kelnick's past 3 months. His swing strike rate has gone down each of the last 3 months. His hard hit rate has gone up each of the last 3 months. So, although it didn't always reflect in the surface numbers, there were a lot of good things happening underneath the hood. Now, when you talk about hitters or evaluate hitters, what kind of things are you looking at underneath the surface? What's important?
Well, you just hit on a lot of it. You know, the very first thing we look at, are they swinging at the right pitches? Because if they're swinging at the right pitches, everything else sort of takes care of itself. And as you alluded to, you know, Jared is swinging less. He's swinging at more strikes, you know, in theory. And the results have been louder. You know, he's hitting the ball harder. When you can box up what you want to swing at and really isolate, and I think now you're starting to see it take even a greater form. 3 months ago, you know, when Jared was locked in, he's swinging at balls that are on the plate. You know, now he's locked in, it's 2-1, it's 3-1, and he's taking the ball that's on the outside corner. He's waiting for the ball that's going to get into his hot zone. That's how you really click at this level. And that doesn't always show up in the numbers. That's something that you can see with your eye. And it's in those cases. And I over the weekend series with the Royals in Kansas City, we did see JK in those situations, those 2-0, 2-1, 3-1 counts. And before, he was just hunting and looking to swing. And if it was even close, he was letting it rip, you know. And he was always swinging like he knew it was going to be a fastball. And most of the time, it wasn't a fastball. Now he started to grasp that in those counts, they don't always throw you fastballs. And if you're looking for that breaking ball, make sure the breaking ball's up. And if you're looking for that breaking ball up, let's try to make sure it's on the inner third of the plate. And you can do the damage in those damage counts. And that's what he has been taught his whole life. It's definitely what he's been taught in our system. And it's what you're starting to see play out now, that his heart rate's gone down. He knows now that he can compete at this level. And now he's starting to thrive.
Jerry, I don't know how you describe what Julio Rodriguez did this year. I'm between Olympic qualifiers, the Olympics, two different levels of minor league ball, full season stateside, an OPS of 1,000 as a 20-year-old. You tell me, what do you make of his season?
The OPS of 1,000 as a 20-year-old, first of all, it's as regardless of where he was playing, whether the Olympics or in Everett or in Arkansas or in Major League Spring Training or in the in-between, he's always been one of the handful of youngest players at that level. I think while in Arkansas, the bulk of his time, he's the second youngest player in the AA Central. And this dates back to spring training with the M's. And at every stop, he OPS'd 1,000, which I think is phenomenal. He did it in big league camp. He did it every stop in between. He did it as the youngest player on the Dominican, you know, national team in the Olympics. And, you know, he's had a star type season. And there's not much you can add to the exclamation point for his year. And to do it at age 20 and to do it in the ballpark that he did it for the second half of the season as a right-handed hitter at Dickey Stevens in Little Rock is doing something. So, you know, glad he's on our side.
I can't imagine just the shuffle that was the geographical shuffle that was this season for Julio. We mentioned the two stints with Team DR for the qualifiers and the Olympics themselves. Then you have the promotion. I mean, that would be a lot to sink a lot of like grown men, let alone a 20-year-old. Maybe 20-year-old energy is what really helps fuel him here. But to me, that stands out as it. Even if he didn't post the numbers that he did, even just to, you know, keep your head a little above water, given his youth, given all that he was all around the country, all around the world, I mean, that's amazing.
Truly is. And you know, when we promoted him to Arkansas, our hope was that he would go there, that he would find his footing, he'd have his little break for the Olympics, he'd come back, and we would use this as an opportunity to start building toward something greater. The something greater was kind of immediate. And, you know, he took off, I think, in his second game there, hit an oppo homer and never looked back. And not an easy place to hit oppo homers as a righty. But, you know, he's just had a remarkable year. He is, you know, this is his 40-man protection year this offseason. You know, like in 2019 with Justin Dunn or Kyle Lewis, Donnie Walton that year, these are the times where historically we've added that player in September to get, you know, sneak peek at Julio and give him a little bit of a taste of it. But some of the new challenges with smaller rosters in September make that, you know, less of a consideration now because you're managing a much smaller group of players. And you know, that being said, not sure you could do more to get us excited about, you know, opening day 2022 in spring training, seeing where Julio can take it and fully believing that there will be a lot of podcast days where we're talking about, you know, Julio's impact, not just, you know, what's happening on the field in Arkansas or Tacoma, but what's happening in Seattle.
What does his offseason look like before big league camp in the spring?
Benny's going to fly a lot of different places based on the, you know, the historic track. You know, he's going to go to our HP camp down in Peoria. You know, our high performance camp we developed in 2016 as an answer to traditional instructional league. So our top prospects, we don't ask them to go play an additional X number of plate appearances or throw X number of innings. We use it as an opportunity to build on education, language skills, what they're doing in the weight room, what they're doing at the dining table, and, you know, and build small skills, not necessarily worry about hitting the 3-0 breaking ball. So, you know, that'll be Julio's 5-week stretch at HP camp, and then my guess is he'll go home for the holidays, and if I have a horse in the game, I'd bet that he plays in the Dominican Winter League for a bit before he shows up for spring training, and when he shows up, he'll be ready to roll, because it's going to be a fun spring to be Julio Rodriguez, and it's going to be fun for us to see where he lands in terms of roster placement to start next season.
Since you kind of led us there, can he do something in spring training like next year that you say, as a, I guess he'd be a 21-year-old at that point, he's ready for this? I mean, is that something that's in the cards for Julio Rodriguez?
Sure. I mean, it is the quick answer. And most of that is because of the foundation he laid this year. You know, he didn't go to Double A or go to the Olympics and survive it. He didn't go and have an interesting run for a 20-year-old. He went and blew the space up. And in both cases, played like, you know, a man among boys. And that there's a difference. You know, he didn't do something interesting for a good prospect. He went and made a loud statement that really players who have all-star upside, you know, make. And, you know, you can't be afraid in those moments, especially as we enter spring training 2022. You can't be afraid to let a star happen if it looks like he's ready. And, you know, we'll be open to that when we get there. Some of that's going to be defined by what we do through the offseason and where we add. But I imagine that we're not going to do anything to block, you know, Julio's progression to the big leagues. It's when you get players like Jared, like Julio, you know, when it's their time, it's their time. You know, make the space and just and then grin and bear it while they go through their turbulent times, because everybody does. But when it gets loud, like it has in September for Jared, and like we believe it will for Julio and others, that's when it's fun.
One name that we've kind of touched on here and there over the course of the last 2 years on the podcast has been Andrés Muñoz, who came over in the deal with the Padres that brought Ty France and so many others over as well. But he had Tommy John, was recovering. We obviously have not seen him. Some Mariners fans probably have forgotten about him, but he breathes fire. He is essentially back or close to being back from TJ. I know he threw in Arizona. Can you tell us what happened there and what the plan for the rest of the year is for Munoz?
Sure. You know, and he's always connected to two things, Andres. Is one, he was one of the four players who we brought back along with Ty France and Taylor Trammell in the trade we made with San Diego last August 31st. And that's worked out quite well for us. And Andres is the one player of the four that has yet to play at the major league level for the Mariners. But he did appear in his first game in a Mariners system down in the ACL this past week. And, you know, the fastball did not register under 100. So he was 100 and 101 for his inning. Struck out all three hitters he faced. Showed us a slider in the mid-80s that, you know, we're trying to work with him on tightening up and throwing a little bit harder. Sounds absurd, but it, you know, his slider, he has and can throw his slider harder, and we think it will really help that pitch develop. But, you know, when I was down in Arizona, when we were playing the Diamondbacks down there, you know, I spent a couple days over at the complex. One of them I crossed over with Andres throwing his bullpen. It was the last of his bullpens before he got into pitching live in games. And the other player that was there with him was Ken Giles, and who's also oft forgotten because, you know, it was a rehab season for Ken, who also breathes fire on the mound. And the two of them together, it was remarkable watching Giles work with Munoz. And it was almost like having an extra pitching coach there with him. And the whole time as I'm watching these guys, I mean, Giles is already throwing in the 90s off a mound and looks every bit of what we thought he would be. And we just talked about where Andres was, who will now go out and pitch in some games in Tacoma and is making his progress back. But I thought, wow, with as many good things as happened in our bullpen in 2021, with a group of players who all come back for the 22 season, and then you add guys like Giles and Munoz, that's a lot of fun. And you know, one thing I will say, that in the world of witty, Ken Giles, when Munoz finished throwing his bullpen, when the last pitch was, I believe, 100.7 miles an hour in a bullpen, where it's hard to generate that type of excitement or adrenaline in a bullpen. But he was throwing 100, and Giles put his arm around Munoz and turned around. I was standing, you know, just about as far away from Aaron, from them, and he turned around. He said, "I'd like to introduce you to your new first-round draft pick, Andres Munoz." And then you thought about it, he's 22 years old. He's a very young man with a lot of career ahead of him, and we're excited to see him healthy.
Well, congrats, Jerry. You just made two statements back-to-back I have never heard back-to-back before. One is, he never registered under 100 miles per hour, and we're trying to get him to throw harder. I've never heard
sliders,
that.
Sliders, yeah.
Is there a sweet spot, generally speaking, and case by case, I realize could be different, where you say your fastball's at this, we want your slider to be X miles an hour slower? I mean, is that a concrete in stone, or does it depend on what those two pitches look like for an individual pitcher?
It depends on what type of break you have, you know, and Andres has an elite break to his slider. And, you know, his slider has ranged the gamut from the high 80s with a short tilt to the low 80s with what I would call a longer horizontal break. And all of them are very good. You know, we're trying to pick one that has a chance to be elite and repeatable. If you use Johan Ramirez's slider, which is also a dynamic slider, as a reference point, Johan could throw five sliders in a game and all five of them are off the charts, and none of the five look anything like the one before it. It's an ever-changing pitch, which is unusual and makes it a little harder to repeat. Then you look at what we saw in Kansas City with Logan Gilbert. You know, when Logan first got here, we saw a longer horizontal break, oftentimes a spiked slider that he was having a difficult time keeping on the plate or getting chases at because it was too visible out of his hand. Here in recent starts, as he winds up the season, we're seeing a tighter, sharper, harder slider that looks like a strike for longer. And as a result, he's getting more chase, more swing and miss. And it's been a far more effective pitch for him. You know, we'd like to see something like that develop for Andres. And he's done it before. Now it's just a matter of focusing in on that one and sticking with the one that we think has the chance to be most impactful.
Hey, we'll wrap up the show as we always do with Stump JD. And this is a very straightforward, very topical question, I must say. We went All-Star Game themed here. Jerry, we're wanting you to tell us which hitter in Major League history has the most career All-Star Game home runs.
Who has the most All-Star Game home runs in history?
Yeah, not in a single game, but in their All-Star Game career.
All-Star Game career.
Who has hit the most All-Star Game home runs?
So I'm going to say that this player had to have played in the years where there were multiple All-Star Games. I'm going to go with Frank Robinson.
That is incorrect.
I'm choosing between Frank Robinson,
problem,
Hank
right?
Aaron,
yeah,
Mickey Mantle,
so many
Willie Mays. Yeah.
And the thing, you know, the more I thought about this, because when Gary and I were talking about it, you think of all the sluggers, and there's more than you can count on two hands, but they're also facing the best pitchers.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's not exactly like a given, right, for even the best hitters, because really good pitching typically beats really good hitting. But you do have to go to a lot of All-Star games, you think. So, do you want to – have you sunk? Do you want to
– There's
I'll tell you this. This is surprising, I think. It was surprising to me. I don't know what you think, Gary. The number is 6, which I would have taken the over.
I would have taken the over, too.
Well, if you think about it, the guys who played in the most All-Star games in history are going to – it's, you know, 20 to 23 All-Star games.
This guy played in 24.
Yeah, that's it. 24 All-Star. So if you play a 24-game season and you hit six home runs, that's a lot of home runs.
Yeah, you're right.
And then you consider that he's facing the best pitchers in the world.
Yeah. You might think that this hitter is maybe the best hitter of all time.
It's Stan Musial.
Oh, Jerry!
I knew there had to be a hook.
How did this question get in? What a shock.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And what's more, he had two more than the next closest, which was Teddy Ballgame.
Wow.
Yes, four for Teddy Ballgame in 18 All-Star games. Now, if you want to go ratios, most home runs to All-Star games played, you would feel pretty good about Fred Lynn, four homers in nine All-Star
including
games.
The first Grand Slam in the history of the All-Star game.
Now, see, now that if I had asked you that, even more niche question, you would have been all over it.
Just happen to see it. Atlee Hammaker.
Now I see why you bypassed my All-Star.
Yeah, let's go. Gary's is impossible.
Do you want a bonus one? Question?
I'm all about bonuses.
But this is a great question. Go for it.
The player with the most career war, the best career war, that never made an All-Star game.
Wow.
the depression that just fell over Jerry's face.
Kirk Gibson.
Oh, so close. It's right there. It's close.
But you face this guy, right, Gary?
Yes.
And he never played in an All-Star game.
And never played in an All-Star game. I faced him four times.
No. Might not stand out. Four times.
Four times.
Not that much.
Did he do anything to torment me in those?
Yeah, just one for four. So
just your standard one for four?
Yeah.
Your standard one for four player from the 90s. Who
Gibson,
never played,
by the way, was third for position players.
In total war?
With ever, without
there is a nuance, and this is Kirk Gibson at his finest.
Yes.
Gibby, in 1988, when he was the MVP of the National League, was selected as a reserve for the All-Star game. I'm not going
Didn't
as a
go.
Reserve.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's he would have had one on his docket. But yeah, I don't know who it is.
Tony Phillips.
Wow.
50.9 career war.
Tony Phillips was like the sneaky, under-the-radar, awesome on-base machine.
Yeah.
To the point where in my second year as a general manager, we had – and this is still – they're at such time when multiple teams still had open workouts for free agent players in spring training. And by free agent players, I mean at your minor league complex, you might have a dozen players from the independent leagues, a couple of non-drafted college players that are out there for an open tryout. Well, we had one such open tryout at the time in Tempe, and Tony Phillips showed up. He was 52 years old. And 52 or 53 years old, and was by far the best player on the field. It was fun, and I'm watching him thinking, man, he's in better shape than most of the players on the field today. And as I understood it, he made his way through most of the teams in Arizona spring training and touched down at each of their camps, roughly insisting that he was better than anybody on their major league team. And he might have been right.
Like he really wanted to play.
Oh, yeah. He wanted to play again. And he was. He was in his young 50s. And, you know, like Julio Franco, he was, you know, he was really put together for a 50-something. He didn't look like this.
By the way, Tim Salmon, number two. So it goes Phillips.
Tim Salmon never played in an All-Star game.
Yeah, I know.
Wow.
Eric Chavez is the other one that always surprises me. He's on that list, too.
Those are shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Tim Salmon had a lot of 30 home run seasons.
Yeah.
Eric Chavez was about as good a two-way player in his generation as you could be with the glove and the power. Oof.
You'll like the pitcher with the most career war that never made an All-Star team.
The pitcher, most career war, never made an All-Star team.
It's a really tough guess.
Then I'm not going there. I don't want to embarrass myself.
Tom Candiotti.
Oh, who is a wonderful – you guys know Candy. Have you ever done Diamondback games?
I've never met him.
Wonderful guy who had a terrific career. And he came up – you know, I came up with the Indians. And – when I was coming to the big leagues, Candy was one of the veteran players on the club and had, I believe, was shortly thereafter traded to Toronto, which started his journey that landed him in with the Dodgers, where I think he had his most notable run outside of the Indians. And in spring training, my roommate, I had a roommate from the University of Texas. His name was Brian Johnson, catcher. Didn't play in the big leagues, but was a second round pick out of college, you know, strapping guy. You know, he looked the part. He was a really good prospect in his time. And Tom Candiotti is throwing his bullpen, you know, at the knuckleball, and Brian's catching him. And the first knuckleball he throws him, and he signals it, you know, and the first knuckleball he throws him gets none of the glove and just got full cup, you know. And you could hear it. You're waiting at the cages for your turn on the mound. And you could, I mean, it was notable. It sounded like a Gary Hill Jr. clap.
Yeah, that was good. That's loud, too. Oh, that's so good. That is painful and enjoyable for us. Jerry, this has been great, man. We appreciate it as always. So thanks for being with us.
You guys do a great job. This is fun. I can't wait to do it again next year.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.